Watergate deaths, about 30 deaths in that period. There's about 80 deaths connected to both the Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassination that I worked on. Two of the judges in the Ray case, dead of heart attacks at critical moments in the Ray's appeal. The mother murdered violently in the church who saw the wounds. The brother who saw the wounds there in Memphis in the morgue, dead fully clothed in the swimming pool in the backyard. 27 witnesses in the Kennedy case died of fast-acting cancer. Under 6 weeks, dead of cancer. Bill Decker, a sheriff there in Dealey, who saw a bullet hit in front of the car and testified to the Warren Commission, got a broken leg and went in, and 6 days later was dead of cancer. Jack Ruby got pneumonia, and within a few weeks was dead of lung cancer. Told people he was being given plain painful injections. In the 1950s, Kurt Blohm was brought to the United States to Fort Detrick Chemical Biological Warfare Labs, a German scientist that had developed viral cancer for the Nazis in the 1930s. So they know how to create cancer. They know how to create heart attacks. There's other suspicious plane crashes. This pattern of death matches exactly the pattern of deaths at the end of the Weimar Republic in Nazi Germany. From 1928 to 1932, 400 unsolved political assassinations wiped out the labor leaders, the musicians, the professors, the people who would stand up and speak out against the rise of fascism or keep Hitler from coming into office, were systematically murdered. The Weimar Republic said, the officials said they knew they were politically motivated assassinations. They said they couldn't solve them. And so, with those out of the way, the fascism rose. In the same way, I believe that many of the key musicians from the counterculture period were murdered, political activists. I did work on Abbie Hoffman's death, among others. Certainly the black activists, the Panther Party and others, were brutally murdered. At each turn in these investigations of the deaths, I found the same modus operandi, the same phony deaths. The coroners repeated, the lawyers reappear, the money follows, the patterns, once they work, they keep using them. And at every turn, I also found in each one of the major assassinations and many of these smaller operations, the spoor of the Office of Naval Intelligence. Which is the operational level, I believe. The purpose of the Committee for an Open Archive is to try to get the files loose and as many files as we can. I just read a book, and finished it, started it, called Unholy Trinity, about the Vatican involvement and the Nazi rat line to bring the Nazis out under Vatican and British and American intelligence control at the end of the war. In the beginning of the book, they talk about where they got the documentation. There's a separate national archive in Suitland, Maryland. The military archive of the United States. These are the classified records of World War II and the Cold War period. They are in underground vaults. The vaults are stacked from floor to ceiling, according to this book, with these classified documents. There are 20 of the vaults holding these records, and each vault is an acre in size. They declassify enough paper at the National Security Agency daily in the winter that they use the paper in the basement to heat the building. But the secret records that are locked up go well beyond the few thousand pages that we'll get from the Warren Commission, the 80 boxes or so from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. So we call not only for those to be immediately open to the public, not the Robert Gates solution. Well, you can have them over a three-year period when a 15-man committee looks at them with a bias toward declassification, of course, and eventually hands them out, like this phony Freedom of Information Act stuff that comes out all blocked off. You know, I don't know if you saw the Saturday Night Live the other day. They put up one of the things saying this has been released from the archive, and it shows this piece of paper all blanked off, one word on it, and the word, they focus in and it says Oswald, and it says, and it indicates that Oswald was the lone assassin in the case. But my favorite cartoon about it is there's a bunch of assassins up on the fifth floor, a whole gaggle of them, sixth floor of the book depository with rifles aiming down into Dealey Plaza. There's boxes in front of the book boxes, and all the boxes are marked Warren Commission report, not to be released until 1964. You know, but I mean, not only do they hide documents, they create documents. We find out about files, they destroy the files, and then we find out the files have been moved someplace else. So the files that you want destroyed, they won't. The files that you do want, they destroy much of the evidence, and the witnesses were killed before the Warren Commission, the House Select Committee. We're able to look into this. George DeMornshield blew his head off with a shotgun just the day before he was to be interviewed by the House Select Committee. Six of the top FBI agents died right in that period, the beginning of 1977. So key witnesses die as the investigations and scandals break. Contragate, a lot of deaths there, you know, that happened. But this is the pattern. On the other hand, these records do belong to us. We do have lists of what went in, so we can check that against what comes out. We don't have to be so cynical to think that there's nothing there. Even the stuff that's been released under Freedom of Information Act, as censored as it is, in each case, the documents have ruined the Warren Commission contention, supported the cover-up and told us more about the case, and backed up the idea that Oswald was not the lone assassin and was, in fact, the patsy. The reason that they've gone to these lengths, besides the historical concentration of power and the fascist ideology that they brought in here and that runs this country now in each of the different technological ways that I think it does, so that we live in the 1984 that's described by Orwell and Winston, if not a post-1984 period where they're actually more powerful, because one of my theses in my work is that 1984 actually describes the year 1948. And then I found out that Orwell's original title for the book was 1948. He'd written it in 1939. As a futurist book, he was a British intelligence operative. He knew what was coming. He was on an inside track. The opposite of that is not to beat them at their own game of secrecy, of terrorism, of manipulation, of militarism, and of violence, but to do something else that they don't understand, which has to do with telling the truth about our own lives to each other, which would crack the code. And then of demanding that democracy be participatory. Get out of the 17th century when you have to send the guy you like the least in a wagon away to the meeting up in Philadelphia weeks away and have him represent you and carry back the news, you know, so you can get on with business. We have instant communication, instantaneous travel. It's public airwaves, they tell us, so let's have the public use them and own them, not these corporate entities. At least 30% of all airtime ought to be devoted to full and complete public debate on issues. We can have straw polls to figure out what those issues are ahead of time. We can allow all sides of the political spectrum to have their say. The population will be educated by the debate. We can not allow any paid advertising to interfere with it. And when we're done, we can take a referendum. The only time I ever registered to vote was in Philadelphia when there was a recall vote for Mayor Rizzo. I believe in voting people out of office. I have one button that says if voting was effective, it would be illegal. Another that says don't vote, it only encourages them. I don't think we need representative democracy. We're too big, we're too complex. You can't represent me, I can't represent you. Let's represent it ourselves with each other. Decide what the issues are. Have some minority issues allowed, you know, out of each 10, maybe 3 would be minority group issues, so that it's not just a majority of people saying what the issues are. The same with tax. If we're going to pay tax, it should be directly allocated. Tax form should have a final page where you say what you want to spend the tax on. We don't have to wait for the government to do this. Let's just mail everybody in the community a copy of a brochure that tells what their taxes go to now and a 3-part form that lets them fill in their own pie. Not what we want them to spend the tax on, but just give them the respect of their own mind and their own decision. Let them fill it in, put one copy in with no legal effect on their tax form when they return it, send a second copy back to the group, and put a third one in the drawer. The group that sends it out and gets the reply envelope can then tally the results. And compiling the results, they can make up a chart that shows what people locally want their taxes spent on. And they can put next to that a chart showing the voting record of the allocation of taxes of the so-called representative that's in office at that point. And then challenge the representative to come out to the press conference and respond and explain why it is that their voting doesn't correspond to what people want, why they've never polled or asked people in their community what they want their taxes spent on, and who it is they really represent. And I'll guarantee you their answer will take them right out of office. Their only answer, and the one they're going to come up with, is the elitist answer that you don't know how to spend your own money. I do. I am the people. You elected me. It's the only response that they've got, other than some mumbo-jumbo about how we need advanced planning and you can't allocate taxes this way fairly or justly, you know. The other argument is that this is a republic and not a democracy, because a democracy is mob rule. Well, it's the rule of the people, all right. Thomas Jefferson said that the back of the seal of the United States shouldn't be this armed eagle with the arrows and everything. He wanted to be a mob scene where the people were pulling a British soldier down off of his horse. You know, and that was his idea of democracy in the United States, that the tyrants aren't allowed to rule. But when they only have to bribe or blackmail or bully or bullet 400 or 500 people, it's not that hard to run the country. Congress is no threat to them. The Soviet Union's no threat to them. Third world is no threat to them. The only reason they go to the lengths they go to is us. We're the only enemy they have left. As long as they can keep us lobotomized with these things and make us think that something else is going on, a little sleight of hand, then we're not going to say no. But on the other hand, we can say no. We can withdraw our consent and our sanction. We can speak out. We can stand with each other and tell the truth to each other. We can even develop a whole separate economy if that's what we want to do. We can extend credit to each other. There ain't no law against it. They do it down at Sears. You know, they have to do it down at Sears because nobody makes enough money to buy the products. They haven't been able to make that much money since the 1950s. That's what started layaway plans and credit scams. And the whole thing is built up. There's $27 billion out in credit in this country. You know, when that collapses, it'll make the 30s recession seem like nothing. But credit is just credit. Money's just money. It's not wealth. It's just lubricant. It's just communication in the economic system. You can issue a separate script, but the IRS will come and the Treasury Department knock your head in, you know, for trying to make a different dollar. But you can figure out an ethical credit method, you know, and you can extend that to each other. And we're going to have to soon because you saw the S&Ls go. The banks are next. It's only a matter of time before the economy goes under. You're not going to be able to rely on them to give you anything. But once we realize what our power is, then we can stand up and take it. Now, the most cynical view would say they're completely in power. There's nothing you can do about them anyway. And in that case, we're dead already. If we're dead already, let's die on our feet and not on our knees. Thanks for coming. I don't know if people have questions or what our time is like. Are we all right to take some questions?
Sure. An older lady that couldn't be here tonight wanted me to ask you if you had anything new on Mae Russell, on how she died. I read the old newsletter about the spooks across the street. And, did they give her Karari toothpaste? Is that what she had cancer, so it couldn't be that?
Well, the uterine cancers, a large part, are viral cancers. It is certainly possible, it has to be looked at, possibility that she was injected. Mae Russell was a researcher who did this kind of work and who I worked with for about 20 years as a housewife in Carmel, and she was the first generation researcher as part of the housewives group, the Clip Papers, Maggie Fields and Lillian Castellano and others that helped Jim Garrison investigation. She stuck with it. She cross-indexed, referenced the Warren Commission, 18,000 pages of notes, until she broke down everybody in it, what their jobs were, who they knew, and not just indexed it, but reference indexed it, so she could figure out who did it. She started clipping newspapers, eventually 15 newspapers a day, 150 periodicals a month, and hundreds of books a year. And then she'd break the news down and connect it back into the historical framework week after week in her broadcast radio show, World Watchers International. She went for something close to 860 weeks before she died in October of 1988 of a fast-acting cancer. That took her. We don't know for sure, or I don't know. I mean, so there's other researchers around her who say that they can say for sure, but I've never seen the smoking gun. It certainly has to be suspect. The house across the street was built, she was told, ahead of time to spy on her, and burned to the ground the day that she died. And we had some indications that the ownership of the house, which wasn't reported in the local paper, links to E. Howard Hunt and some of the top intelligence people, but we don't know that for sure. I mean, there were just some indications in papers that tied names together, and I don't know of anybody that's done more work on it, unless Dave Emery's done something that I haven't heard. I've been off the West Coast for a while, so I don't hear his show. He was a fellow researcher with May and suspicious of it. I think we have to be suspicious of that kind of a death. I think a precipitating thing would be that both her mother and her father died. She was from a very rich family, the Magnin family, Rabbi Magnin down in Los Angeles, ran the main temple down there, and was very tight with Nixon and some of the big money. It was the I. Magnin fortune from the department stores. They had sold the department stores, but it was that money. And at the end, they realized May wasn't going to change, and they started giving her some money, $50,000 a year. But if there was a reason to sort of tip their hat and let her survive, because you could discredit her and call her crazy easier than killing her, there was no reason after the parents were dead not to go in and get her. I found when I went into her collection, she left the collection to me to form the Mae Brussels Research Center, I found letters threatening her life from people she'd been exposing on the radio in the few weeks before she went off the air. And she got very serious death threat about a month before she went off the air from somebody saying he was going to come up and blow her head off. He was a fascist, and he was proud of it, and he was going to come and do that to her, and she felt that it was a serious threat. Wasn't carried out right at that point, but somebody did come in the house, and there was a little note left, and I found the note that said, it was a piece of a jigsaw puzzle taped to a piece of paper, and it said, we were here. This was when she'd gone out and left her security system on. It was a message to her that somebody was able to get into the house. But as I said, I don't have any smoking gun. I don't think... Well, you can introduce it. David Ferry had hundreds of white rats in his apartment. He'd been feeding and ingesting with cancer as part of experiments that were carried on and reported on in articles in Louisiana medical journals. And the doctor that worked with him, a woman doctor, was publishing these articles and worked with them on experimentation, also died a very violent death there in New Orleans, was either stabbed or shot, depending on whose report you read, burned to death in an apartment in a strange fire that only burned the lower half of the apartment, sort of like these internal combustion fires that the satellites can create. But it was just apparently a very fast heat flash, and then it was over. But she and Ferry had discovered that you could feed rats or inject rats with certain cancers and they would pick up in the system. Martha Mitchell told people she was being given painful injections. I talked to a pathologist at the hospital who told me when Ted Kennedy came in with a kid who had trouble with his leg and they eventually amputated the leg, that the first samples from the leg showed no cancer whatsoever. And then immediately the leg was said to be full of cancer, and then after they cut it off the biopsy showed no cancer again. But the panel he was on wasn't responsible. A private doctor was brought in and made the decision to amputate. And about 6 months later, I saw a tiny article saying the Kennedys were commiserating with a family whose son's leg had been cut off due to a misdiagnosis of cancer. I think Kennedy is kept where he was by the fear. Many people ask me if this is true, why haven't the Kennedys spoken? Part of it is the fear. He told one of the Boston Globe columnists the reason that he wasn't running for office was the bullets, the bullets, the bullets. And the other reason is that Kennedys were a ruling class family, still are, had a great deal of dirty money from the father, have their own skeletons in the closet, so start spilling the beans on somebody else, more could come out on them. Jackie, all you have to do to me is repeat her name, Jacqueline Bouvier Auchincloss Kennedy Onassis, to understand whether she'll go with the money or she'll speak out about it. And I think it's essentially true for the rest of the family, but I find it weird not being a Kennedy file, not being someone who, you know, would have voted for Kennedy, even though he was certainly more liberal and moving in a direction that history had pushed him in that period than many of the people that killed him, why it rests on the shoulders of me and some other little handful of researchers. Didn't John Kennedy have a friend who was honest enough to ask, how was my friend killed? Or are they all just too afraid to even bring it up? Did somebody else have a question? Yes, the aides did see one thing there and told the FBI, you know, that they shot from the front and changed their stories later on. And Penn Jones, one of the researchers, called O'Donnell and was trying to talk to him about it. And O'Donnell said, I don't care where the bullets came from. All I care about is my friend is dead. Kennedy is dead. He said, it doesn't make any difference to me where those bullets came from. And Penn replied, well, it damn sure makes a difference to the nation. We have some materials up here, free at one end and for sale here, and my book, Judge for Yourself, and some other things. So thank you very much for your time and for coming.
one of those flying saucers they carry, it could be
That's
one.
That's Nazi technology they brought here.
The Russians came from